You're listening to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Just behind the state capitol in downtown Juneau, you will find a bronze empty chair in a far corner of a park. It's hard to see it in the snow, a memorial to Juneau's Japanese families forced from their homes and sent to internment camps during World War II. The empty chair is for John Tanaka, who was supposed to be seated at his high school graduation that year to be honored as the valedictorian. The Tanakas were known as the Tanakas because the Tanakas were too polite to correct the townspeople. That's what Mary Lou Spartz recalls. She just turned 90 this month, but in 1942, she was 11 years old and had just lost her good friend, Alice Tanaka.
They were a Japanese family that came here and opened a restaurant called the City Cafe, where the tram is now.
So what kind of restaurant was this?
It was a general restaurant. The family worked in it. They were open 7 days a week, holidays. They were always there because they were serving the population that were miners at that time from the Alaska Juneau gold mine. It was the mill was just up above them from their restaurant. So many of the miners, I think, counted on them for their evening meal or for their lunch meal or whatever. And so that was their business.
And so what happened to the Tanakas?
Well, they were very well accepted in the community. They had four children. Their son John was the oldest, and he was very, very bright and wanted to be a doctor. When the war came along in 1941, the family, of course, was part of those Japanese families that were taken out of their communities and out of their homes and interned in Japanese internment camps. And that's what happened to them.
And how did the town react?
Well, I don't think we understood until they were gone that they were gone. I didn't understand why they were gone. I couldn't imagine my friend in Girl Scouts being a Japanese spy. That just didn't seem reasonable. They didn't have time to say goodbye, or at least I didn't know about it.
What about at the high school? How did people react to John being pulled out of the community?
Well, John was scheduled to be the valedictorian of that class, that 1942 class. As I understand it, they had a small private ceremony where they presented him with his diploma, and then he was whisked away to where they were in their internment. And then in the spring, when the regular graduation took place, there was an empty chair. These are folding chairs that were folded put out there for the graduation in the gymnasium where it was always held. There was one empty chair.
Do you think that we need to kind of remember these things, that there are these things that happen and that they can always happen again?
It is so sad that we have to go through these periods when we land on one race or one group of people or another, or one of these days maybe we'll land on blue-eyed people or brown-eyed people. We will treat them with this same violent response. Where does it stop? When does it stop? I don't know.
Mary Lou Spartz of Juneau, remembering a time that feels oddly too familiar these days. And for Sam Keto Jr. and Marie Nash, this recent wave of anti-Asian hate hits even closer to home. Today, Sam Keto is a legislative lobbyist and known as a longtime Native rights activist. Marie Nash is retired after working for many years as an aide for Senator Ted Stevens. But back in the early 1940s, they were at the same internment camp where the Tanakas were sent. A chapter in history that reminds us this is not the first time Asians have been targeted because of their race or nationality. Sam, you were very small when you were there. Do you remember very much at all?
Well, I remember being there. I was five, going on five. Then we moved from there to Anderson Dam, and we ended up living there for about a year after my father and my uncle were brought back from New Mexico, Lordsburg, New Mexico. So we didn't spend until the end of the war in Minidoka.
So your family was separated when they were pulled out of Petersburg?
Yeah, my father and my grandfather and my uncle, they went to Lordsburg, New Mexico, and then we went to Puyallup and then Anderson Dam.
Why did they separate you? Why didn't they keep the family together?
Well, because my father and my uncle and my grandfather were first-generation Japanese, I guess they had some idea that they had roots too deep in Japan. And so all those that had those roots in Japan, they suspected. So they put them in Lordsburg, New Mexico, while they did research and investigation of their backgrounds, I guess, because all of them did get released to Anderson Dam.
Did your parents talk very much to you about how they felt about what was happening, Sam?
I don't know about you, Marie, but my father and mother, they used to talk about it, but not too much, because we ended up in the camp together, and then we went to Anderson Dam, and we were a family unit. And so from that point on, there was not a lot of interchange in family life that we talked about it.
Right. Our family didn't talk about it much either. There were some comments here and there. I think Lordsburg was either run by the Immigration or Department of Justice, where they checked on some people further to make sure they were loyal to the U.S. I think that was my understanding, Sam.
Yeah,
and then,
that's
like
right.
You say, they were permitted to join their families in Minidoka. But when they first went to Puyallup, that was a fairground that was owned by the state, as I understood it, and I think the federal government just took it over. And then, like Sam said, housed people in those stalls, and they were horrible. They were on mattresses out of the hay, and of course they smelled a lot. It was really unbearable for them. And then when they went to Idaho, it was just as bad, because the conditions there were so different from what people were used to in Alaska. It was dry and dusty, and the buildings weren't very secure, and dust came through the wood slats. Anyway, people had no privacy, and I think they just hung blankets or something between units at first, and maybe eventually they did build sturdier walls. But our family just didn't talk about it, and I hear bits and pieces, and I think it was in high school in Haines that our teacher talked about it, and then I started learning more and more. And back then, we didn't think to ask our parents a whole lot about it either. My dad ended up serving in the Army, and he was part of the 442nd and fought in both France and Italy and received Purple Heart and some other medals. After the war was over, he came back a long route. He started a little diary of what countries he was coming through, but he didn't quite finish it. But we have a collection of his coins and paper bills from the different countries, as well as postcards he bought. There's so much history there that I wish we had documented it and talked to him and asked questions. But we also had his little Bible. They were issued a little Bible and a little book of prayer. And believe it or not, they had the president's name inside of them, the one that signed the order to put everybody in the encampments. I mean, that to me was a surprising thing, but maybe those Bibles and prayer books helped them when they were at war. I don't know.
So what was it like to be a kid in the camp?
Well, you know, it was very close living. There was four children, plus my mother. We lived in a one room with two bunk beds, and my mother had a single bed. You ended up slats in the floor. You could see the ground below, and there wasn't any insulation on the sides, and they had a potbelly stove in the corner, and there was five of us that lived there, and my father was there, and then that meant six in one room, and the room is probably a little smaller than a living room in a regular house, but half the size of a living room. It wasn't that large.
Marie, you were born there, so did your family tell you much about your birth? Were you taken to a hospital? Were you born in a rough building?
You know, I don't know, but when I went back there for the Minidoka pilgrimage in 2014, I think I went with a friend, I wanted to go to see what it was like because, like I said, our families didn't talk to us about it. So I had questions like Sam did, and I wanted to see it firsthand. And it's now under the National Park Service, and they've been trying to rebuild a lot of the facility there. They had barbed wire fences to keep the people inside, and the way they knew is the barbed wire was pointing inside instead of outside to keep outsiders away, but it was to keep the Japanese Americans inside. And then they had those towers where they had military guarding them to make sure they didn't escape. One tower had been rebuilt when I went. One of the buildings was donated back. After the war ended, local people from Idaho were allowed to take the land and farm it. And then I think they, I don't know if they were given the buildings or bottom. They were trying to reconstruct that building to the way it was when people were housed there. Well, I talked to this one lady that talked about being born with the help of a midwife who helped her mom deliver her. And I asked why, and she said she didn't know. And the only thing we could think of was maybe the hospital wasn't built, because she was a year or two older than I was. So maybe the hospital got built, and that's why I was born in a hospital. My birth certificate is really bizarre. It was a full sheet, and I was always embarrassed to have to show it when I was asked to show my birth certificate. I was really ashamed of pulling this thing out and the explanation, and it didn't make sense to me. But anyway, eventually I did get a regular little card birth certificate that said I was born in Idaho. It had the doctor's name and, of course, my mom and dad and how many births she had before. Stuff like that, you know, that was really kind of personalized. That's personal. That's why I hated to drag it all out instead of just having the little card that normal people have, like a driver's license.
Sam and Marie, did your parents, while they didn't tell you about the circumstances of being in the camps, did they talk about what they lost as a result of being forced to move away from their homes?
Well, let's go over that. When we left, we ended up leaving a lot of items in Petersburg, according to my mother and father. After the war, we went to stay in Juneau for a year, year and a half, I guess it was. Then we went back to Petersburg. But everything that we had in Petersburg, you know, was still there. And as a matter of fact, the neighbors that we had where we were living were John and Ann Colstrand, and he was the blacksmith in Petersburg. They sent us Christmas and birthday gifts in camp. Sometimes it took a month to get there, and we did have some communication with them and with some of the people in Petersburg. And when we returned, there wasn't any animosity that I could recall. Some of the families that were Japanese, and on the father's side, that the mothers were not Japanese, and the children were allowed to stay with the mother. But my mother, you know, she decided to go to the camp with the children. So there was some Japanese men that married into families in Petersburg where the children went to school there.
So your mother wasn't Japanese then?
Well, she was half Japanese.
So because she was half then, she didn't have to go, but she chose to go.
Yeah, she chose to go. She didn't have to go, but she chose to go.
So what did your dad do for a living in Petersburg before they were interned?
He worked in the cold storage. He worked for the same cold storage that he ended up coming back to work for, and he worked there for until he retired.
So, Marie, how about your family, did they lose a lot when they were forced to move?
Yes, our family situation was different. When they came back to Alaska, they had to get permission from the Department of the Army to return after the war ended. And when they came back, everything was gone. Someone had taken their home. I don't know who that was. I never did ask which one was our house before they were evacuated. Growing up there, I always had a funny feeling like I was a guilty one. I always felt weird, but I think it was maybe the people in the village felt weird toward us because of what they'd done to us. I don't know. Our folks had to start over, and there was this older house there that had belonged to a family member. It was kind of built many years ago, and the doorway was really low when people were kind of short. And we lived in that on a temporary basis, and then my dad started building another house next door to that. But the nice thing was that the people in the village helped us build a new house. But I never thought about the stuff that was taken until my sister said to me one day, "Do you think our mom feels weird going to people's houses to have coffee or tea, and then they're serving her in her dishes and tea sets?" And I had not thought of it so precisely that way, and I thought, my gosh, yeah, that must have been weird. But she never said anything, and nobody ever said anything to her. And to my knowledge, none of her belongings or their belongings were ever returned back to them. They sort of had to start over. But like I say, it was nice that the villagers did help our family rebuild a house, a new house.
So where were you at that time when they were rebuilding?
Ugashik, that was the village they were removed from. It's in Bristol Bay on the Alaska Peninsula. And my dad had been a fisherman there. He was originally born in Hawaii. That's why he was not at the same camp as Sam's dad. So he was an American citizen, and he was born in Hawaii but left home at an early age. I think he worked in the fruit and vegetable fields in California and then worked his way up to Seattle, where he boarded a fishing boat to come up to Alaska to fish, and he ended up in Bristol Bay and became a fisherman out there. But after living there a long time, he actually learned a lot of things from the locals. He learned how to build a dog sled and raise his own dogs and had a dog team, and then he hunted and trapped. And he actually built a cabin in the Upper Lake area, and we used to go up there in the winters, and he would either take us up by a dog sled if the snow had fallen, or if we were going up before that, a guy from Pilot Point would fly us up and land us in a small lake and real close to the house. And their old house, the frame of that old cabin is still up there.
One of the things that is interesting about Juneau, of course, is that the empty chair statue is there to remember John Tanaka, who didn't get to graduate, and they left an empty chair for him. And right now it's covered in snow, and you can barely see it right now. But that chair, for many people like yourself, must have tremendous significance.
Well, for me, it does, because we moved back, and I stayed there for a year and a half, I guess, 2 years maybe, before I moved back to Petersburg. But the people that were in Juneau, families that were there, two families moved from Petersburg to Juneau, but the Juneau people, the Japanese, invited us to participate in the empty chair. The people that graduated with Tanaka were the ones that raised the funds to build the chair, because there was an empty chair that at the graduation ceremonies, and his classmates were the ones that were the impetus, put together the organization to remember what the empty chair meant.
In our country, we're always on to the next thing, always on to the next thing, and things get buried very quickly in our memory. But in your memories, what lifelong lessons do you take from this?
The Juneau people that stood by the Japanese Americans who were removed and took care of them when they returned, and they had good feelings about them. They were family and friends. They respected the Japanese people that lived there, that made a part of the community, and especially the diner. Those folks there really helped out a lot of the people in Juneau during the mining days and put their bills on a tab and kept track and helped people out when they were hungry. And so I think the feeling of reciprocity and the warmth of genuine love and caring for each other as human beings is what got my attention. I think that was the other thing that helped me too in going back to the village, was the fact that people stepped up and helped us. And it saddens me to see what's going on in the country today and across the world, just because of people's skin color, they're being impacted and terrible things are being done. And I hope that our country can step up to the plate and be better citizens to each other.
Sam Keto and Marie Nash both say they've visited the camp at Minidoka, Idaho, and are glad it's being turned into a memorial to remind future generations of where we have been and how now we need, as a nation, more than ever, to call upon our better angels.